Hey yo, and here we go, another episode of We Talk Music on the air and in your ear. Once again, I am Martin, and I got with me the king of the casters, as we call him, Mr. Brett Podcast. But Brett, it's not about you. We have a guest on. We're so excited. He's been in a band or two. I think it might be because he's one of the best at his profession in the world.
It is true. Yeah, I mean, he plays guitar. He plays guitar really well, and he plays guitar really well for, well, Whitesnake and Winger. He's played guitar for Dokken and for himself, and of course a wonderful band called Black Swan. He is Reb Beach, and Reb, you know, thank you so much for being on the show. We're big fans, and so happy to be able to talk to you.
Oh, that's so nice to hear. Thank you, guys. That's great. Thanks for having me. This is a fun show. I look forward to this for sure.
Well, great. I mean, and of course, you know, we're here to talk about, immediately to talk about A View From the Inside, your actual No Voices album, which is fantastic. I mean, we love hearing a good No Voices album, and, you know, we love calling it No Voices because that's what Brian Wilson calls them, and Brian Wilson is great.
Yeah, he is great, for sure. What a songwriter he is, and yeah, it's different, for sure. I wanted to do something. I've been wanting to do this for a very, very long time, and I'm excited that it's finally being released because people have been asking me about it for about 10 years. So, I'll tell you how it all started. It was 1993 when Winger kind of was shot down in flames with everybody else. All the 80s bands were done overnight. And I was thinking, well, maybe I'll be like a Joe Satriani guy and I'll do like an all instrumental record. So I made demos and I sent them to every record company I could. Nobody was interested because there were no voices. They wanted it to sound more like Winger. So I put them for sale on my website, and it was the actual demos, and they were just crappy sounding demos, like on recorded on a 8-track cassette player. But I got letters from all over the world saying, my favorite thing you've ever done is the fusion demos. And I thought that was amazing. So little by little, I worked on it in my studio. Once I got a studio, I started just doing this little project at night. It was almost like when you read about housewives in the Midwest who don't have anything to do, like in the daytime on the farm. So they make jelly. And they have like boxes of jelly at the end of the year. And so this is what this kind of was. Little by little, I just kept, you know, creating until the thing was done. And it wasn't until COVID when I asked Kip Winger, what the heck am I going to do now? And he said, what'd you ever do with that fusion stuff you've been working on forever? And I said, oh, God, that's done. That's in my hard drive. He said, why don't you release it? I said, oh, that's a good idea. So that's why I was able to do that and have this kind of free time, because I'm a touring musician. I'm always out on the road or, you know, writing for something that's more, you know, has to be out there, that has a deadline, like Black Swan or Winger or Whitesnake. So this was a thing where I could just do it in my own spare time, which is why it took a while to happen. But I like all the songs and I'm really happy with it. So we'll see how it does.
Yeah, I mean, it's so fascinating to think about the instrumental music nowadays, and it's funny how it has a tendency to, you know, like envelop you, I think, and you just kind of forget what you're doing other than listening to the music, and I think that's a really good thing.
I've had other people say something similar, that they like it. It's refreshing to listen to something and not be distracted by the lyrics or the singer, really. It's all kind of different styles of music, and it was really relaxing to some of the people that I talked to, that they did it when they were riding their car to work for a half an hour. It's not a long record, you know, jogging or whatever. It's just been relaxing, apparently, to some people who've heard it.
The thing that makes an album like this work to me is that even though there's no voices technically, the guitar is the voice. The guitar sings. You know, that's what gives it the personality. It's still got voice. It's just a little bit different to get used to.
Well, thanks. That's what I was going for, really. But, you know, I don't like those guitar instrumental records that are all just shred from top. Yeah. You know, it just starts with like as fast as you can possibly play. And then the middle as fast as you can possibly play. And the end is also as fast as you can possibly play. And the next song is a shredder song. And then all this stuff. And I wanted to do something with more of a variety of music And also keep it interesting. That's the thing. It was all about the writing on this record. It was a challenge to write instrumental music that doesn't lose the listener because there's no vocal. So I tried to write guitar melody lines that were hooky. Each song has a hook. Each song has a chorus. And I tried to make it as memorable as possible, yet have some good jams in there.
Yeah, no, it's definitely true that every song has its own personality. And I think that's the difficult thing to master when you're doing a instrumental album. Give each song its own personality, and that's what you managed to do. And that became obvious, you know, about three tracks in, I'm like, oh, he's got it going on this album. He's got that. He's got, you know, that different personality per song, and yet they all flow sequenced together really beautifully, which is another challenge, I'm sure.
Yeah, thanks, Martin. I kind of did a little work on which songs work best after each other. You know, what's the sequence of songs that works the best? So we tried a bunch of different ways and found the one that I thought worked best. You know, sometimes there'd be a song that was too good. I didn't want it at the end. We got to put the Way Home much closer to the front because that was one of my favorites. And that was the last song I wrote. So there was definitely, times like that.
I think
please go ahead, Brad.
Well, I was just going to say, I think my favorite is Little Robots, actually. So
that's my favorite song on the record.
Mine too.
So
cool. Oh my God, I'm not kidding.
That's so great to hear. Thank you so much. I really, really appreciate that a lot. That was the first fusion song I ever wrote, and I wrote it in 1986.
Wow.
Yeah, but it didn't make it to the Fusion demos thing,
right,
because
yeah.
the demo of it just sounded really bad. And that's a melody line that I loved. It's kind of a Jeff Becky melody line. And I needed a melody line for an instrumental on one of the albums I did. It was either Masquerade or The Mob. And it's the exact same melody, but it's a boogie. You know, I use that exact same melody line on another instrumental song, but Little Robots was written first. Yeah, there you go. And you know, there's some other older songs on there, Black Magic and Cutting Loose. They were written in like 89. Cutting Loose, I get more questions on that song over the years than any other song. People always ask me, what's that first song on your instructional video from 1989
with
your giant hair that looks like a cake? And I said, it doesn't have a name. It's nameless. It's just a song I wrote for the video. So then I said, why not redo that and just call it Cutting Loose, because that was the name of the video. And so people, you know, they dig that song because it's got some cool whammy bar stuff going on. And then Black Magic, of course, that was released already. That was going to be the first single for this, but the label said no because it had already been released, even though it was 31 years ago. It was sort of old news. And I was giving a lesson a couple months ago to a Japanese student, and I said, that's so cool. You want to learn Black Magic. How do you know that song? He said, what, are you kidding? Everybody in Japan knows that song. I said, why does everybody in Japan know that song? He said, because they use it at all of the sporting events. For like baseball, which is huge there, when the announcers are announcing and talking about the different players, they play Black Magic as a bed. And I said, oh, God, I hope I'm getting money for that. So I looked at my statements, and sure enough, I was getting paid for all these years and had no idea. I just thought it was Winger money, but it was Black Magic. And so I'm hoping that they hear this new version and use that. That would be great. Because it sounds so much better, and that's the reason I redid it, because the original is an SR-16 drum machine that fits in the palm of your hand.
Right.
You know, those sounds are just tiny. So I redid it with a real bass player and a real drummer, and that's a rockin' song. Came out great.
Fantastic.
Who are the other musicians playing on this album with you?
So Dave Throckmorton is the drummer that I long to play with. He is my favorite drummer in the world. Even though I've played with the greatest drummers in the world, he's my favorite because he's so unique and he's, little known. He played with Maynard Ferguson for a while, but he's one of those guys that can play jazz and rock, and he has his own style. When he plays his kit, it sounds like an entire band is playing, and you can't even see his hands. They're moving so quickly. And so he played on Masquerade, my 2003 solo album, of which I sang on. And also he plays in the Red Beach Project, which is my little outfit that we play around town when we can. And the only reason I do the Red Beach Project is so I can have the opportunity to play with Dave Throckmorton. And then John Hall, who plays in the Red Beach Project, he played on a few songs. And then Philip Bino, the bass player for Steve Vai, he played on the record. And then I got a keyboard player. I needed a keyboard player, and Kip Winger and Paul Taylor knew a dude named Paul Brown, who was like a funk guy who played the organ. Really super sweet guy and plays his ass off. And he did all the keyboards on most of the songs. I played keyboards on a few songs. And then Michele Lupe on Aurora Borealis. We were on tour with Whitesnake, and there was a guy who knew a guy who had a piano in his church. And we went there, and we put up the laptop and just recorded Michele on the piano for that. It sounds a little choppy because I wrote it in a terrible key for the piano. It's in like B flat or something horrible. And when I played the original, I just pressed transpose on my little keyboard to you know, be able to play it all in the white keys. But anyway, yeah, that's a duet with me and Michele, Aurora Borealis, and it's hard to say, and it's a it's a way better name than it used to be named, Aurora Borealis. The song doesn't sound anything like Aurora Borealis. It's a Irish jig, but the original name for it was Finnegan's Wake, and I played it for Rod Morgenstein and told him I need a better name, and he said, how about Aurora Borealis? And I said, well, I like it better than Finnegan's Wake. It's a good name. And frankly, it's an instrumental song, and I can call it whatever I want. You know, Frank's Pizza, whatever.
Suddenly, yeah, I always, really I want you to call a song that. Frank's Pizza, but like
Frank's Pizza. Yeah,
I was like, I was thinking this actually. I don't know why it came to me, you know. But I'm listening to your album. I'm going, man, you know, how do they name those songs? They got no voices. How do they name those songs? And then I thought, you know, I wish somebody would name an instrumental song. Your wife is cheating on you, just for.
See, and you can get away with that too. That's the beauty of it. And that's one thing I love about instrumental songs is that they're a lot easier to name because you can just call it anything. You know, anything it makes you feel, whatever it makes you think about. Paul Gilbert has great names for his songs. Mm, you know?
It is so true.
I think as far as names, I think Attack of the Massive and Hawk Dance are my two favorite names for songs. Wow. Those are great, great titles.
Well, thank you. Attack of the Massive. What is the most difficult song on the record. It's a big, long tour de force live jam. And I almost put a fake live audience on there, but I didn't because it would just sound so cool live, you know? Yeah. You know, like Do You Feel Like We Do by Peter Frampton. Like that was the whole, that was what I was thinking when I wrote that song, is to have a breakdown in the middle where, you know, it just jams. And I got the name from a keyboard patch on my keyboard. I bought a new keyboard, and there was a patch called Attack of the Massive. I'm like, that's perfect for that song. Like, because I love Godzilla. I'm a member of the Godzilla fan club, and so I'm really into, like, you know, giant monsters. And so it was just perfect. And then Hawk Dance, I got that because when I hear that song, I think of David Coverdale sidestepping across the stage with his, like, crab step, you know. Walking sideways, just kind of funking out to, you know, Fool for Your Lovin' or whatever song that we're playing. That's how I got Hawk Dance. It's David Coverdale's dance that he does on stage.
Oh, yeah, we're familiar with that dance, but now I know what it's called.
Oh, man. Now, when you talk, of course, about like, talking to some of these other people, and you know so many amazing people. So, like, when you are doing this and doing the songs, like, did you send them to other people to get, like, input and that kind of thing when, like, as you were going through them?
No. No, that's the great thing. Another great thing about this is that it was just all mine. And I wanted to do what I wanted to do. I never had places where I wasn't sure. You know, if I wasn't sure, I kind of trusted myself. This is my area. You know, when it's instrumental music, you're not talking about lyrics and melodies that you sing. It was all guitar. So that's an area that I know. And like I said, it was just late at night. You know, for years, just a little bit here and a little bit there. So I got to really analyze it and live with it for, you know, a couple weeks and go, no, you know what? I don't like that. And so I never really sent it to anybody, to tell you the truth. Sometimes I would play it for the guys in Whitesnake on the bus a little bit. And, you know, they would just say, sounds great.
Yeah.
I just, when you're writing a song, then do you can kind of conceptualize the entire song before you sit down to craft it? Or is it a lot of improvisation and improve and just kind of wiggling with it as you're doing it?
It's just like every other thing that I do. It's just like the 80s rock thing. So with Winger, with Black Swan, it all starts with me. It all starts with the guitar riff. You need that to get going. Because like Black Swan and Winger, are guitar riff bands. So you need that to start with. And that's what we do. I've been writing with Kip now for a long time now, a few months, and we sit down, I start playing. And he walks around the house because when he sits right in front of me, I never come up with anything good because he's staring at me. I'm like, just go get out of here. And he walks. He knows to do that. And then, like, he'll be sitting in the bathroom and I'll play something and he'll be like, what's that? And I'm like, I don't know. Is that good? Yes, that's good. Let's work on that. And so it goes from there. And, you know, I brought 15 ideas to Kip for this latest album. And he liked him and everything, but he prefers it when it's right off the cuff, right in the room with him. And he said, I don't want a guitar lick where I know what the next chords are going to be after I've heard the first couple of chords. And so, you know, that he raises the bar like that. He wants Winger to be a progressive thing with the guitar riffs that he sings a pop melody over, much like 17. It's not so progressive, but it's a very busy line that you wouldn't think you could sing a chorus over. And he, the second he heard it, he said, oh my God, that's a chorus. I'm like, that's a chorus? It sounds like a like an intro or something, but not a chorus. And that's the way Winger is. But Black Swan was just Winger ideas that Kip said no to. And I had 50 of them and I brought them into Jeff Pilson and he was like a kid in a candy store. He said, I like this one. I like this one. I like this one. I like this one. And you know, excitable guy to begin with. And so it was such a fun experience because we just took off. He knew right what to do with my ideas. And that's the thing about me. I need a collaborator because I never finish songs. I'm great at writing guitar riffs. I can write guitar riffs all day long. They just spew out of me. And I need a guy or a girl to put them and go, okay, that's a chorus. This is a verse. Now we need something in A, play something in A, and I can do that. So it's kind of the same thing. Like with Infinito, somebody asked me how I wrote that. And that started with a guitar riff. And I saw somebody on YouTube playing it, which was a great honor that someone actually, you know, was playing my song that's not even out yet. And he was just going E, C, D. I would never write that. That's a very stupid lick. What's cool about Infinito is that it's only one finger on one string at any given time in that lick. So it's just, and you move the finger up one fret, and then you put one finger on the third fret B string. So it's, and all these cool tones come out. And I, you know, I must have discovered it like by mistake. And so as soon as I heard that, I said, well, that's an intro right there. You know, that's totally, that's a song. I heard the whole song. And that's how it happens.
That's amazing.
I can see just from that alone why you'd be an effective teacher.
Yeah. I'm a good teacher. I am a really good teacher. I've given 200 lessons now.
Wow.
And I've got a knack for it. People keep coming back. I have one guy, he's taken 32 lessons from me. And now he's like a good friend of mine. Like, I love this guy. Like, I don't even charge him anymore. And then I have a couple in the UK that do it every week. And they don't even play guitar. They just like to listen to me tell stories of the road. And they sit there and drink Guinness.
I get the feeling we could do that.
Yeah, I know.
I think you must have a story or two.
I got
maybe after all those years.
Yeah.
I, you no, know, it's,
Oh, go ahead, Brett.
Well, I'm just, you know, it's fascinating to hear you talk about it and, of course, see you play. Like, because one of the things that I'm really interested in is just your relationships with the people outside. I mean, you've worked with so many great people. I mean, you talk about Kip Winger. We know about David Coverdale, but also, like, even when you get to Jeff Pilson and Robin McCauley, I mean, these singers are amazing.
Oh, he's amazing, yeah.
You know, and so, like, what's it like then to work with that caliber of musician?
You know, it's never fun if you've got someone in the band who can't pull their weight. You know, you don't want like a guy in the band who's, especially you don't want a bad singer. So, you know, that happened when I was young, but, I guess from the success I've had, I've been able to work with some of the best in the business. So, you know, I'm not really used to working with, musicians that aren't really good. And so, I mean, when you say, what's it like to work with them? I'm just so used to it. It's been 30 years that I've been doing it. It's just kind of how it is. You know, you play with Alice Cooper and all those guys have to be really good or else they wouldn't get the gig. And I mean, the reason I got that gig is because of my voice. It wasn't because of my guitar playing. It's because I was the only guy with the 20 people that were there, including Warren DeMartini. I was nervous as a cat. I just went up to the mic and I was like, Poison! And Alice Cooper was like, you got the gig. As soon as I did that, he's like, we're done. That guy.
Yeah, I mean, and harmonies are so important, of course, for sure.
Yeah, you need a guy who can be, and I think a big reason I got Whitesnake was because of my voice. It was going to be Earl Slick.
Wow.
He's a good, like, rhythm guitar player, yeah. But he's not a shredder guy, you know? He didn't sing, and so I was next up in line, and that's how I got it.
I can't picture that at all. Like, I mean, and I'm a fan of Earl Slick's work, but it's just like, when I think of Whitesnake especially, like, just that kind of, like, just a guy who does, dirty blues is not quite the right guy.
Yeah, and David was, you know, David's friends with him, and so David liked the idea for something different. But, I'm glad I ended up. I think of Whitesnake, and I think of all, you know, shred guys, and, you know, guys that are, you know, big names like Steve Vai. So it definitely is an honor. You know, there's one audition I didn't get in my life, and it was Hall & Oates. The reason I didn't get it is because I don't read music. So, sorry about that. That's my email, I guess. I don't read music. And so I went to the audition and I played whatever the song was. And they said, well, you're playing the wrong. It's the right chord, but you're playing the wrong inversion. You have to play it up here. And I'm like, I don't know that chord. I have to like go home and learn that chord. And so I didn't get it. But 2 weeks later, I got Whitesnake. And a year later, I saw the Hall & Oates guys that I auditioned with. And they said, man, you got the Whitesnake gig. You're so lucky. And they said, man, if you know, playing Rich Girl every night is like, you know, so boring. You just stand there and play, you know, you're a rich girl and you know it's gonna. And you know, it's not a rock thing. Like, and it made me think, wow, Whitesnake is really the ultimate guitar gig to have. And I've been in it longer than anyone else, 17 years. So I can't complain. You know, I'm a happy camper that I've had that gig for so long. It really is a good one. Can't get much better than that.
Yeah. I mean, thinking about like Adrian Vandenberg, I mean, you know, the guys who were in it early, you know, Marston Moody, that kind of thing. Yeah.
You ever hear that Vandenberg record?
Yes. I love it. Amazing stuff.
I love that album. The worst lyrics ever. like so bad. Like, there's this song called Wait, but it's wait, wait, wait till the shit hits the fan. It's like, no. Yeah, and there's the one song, it's a really good song called Lost in the City, and it's like, it's the worst lyrics ever. It's like, you know, I bumped into some guy, and I didn't know where I was. So I said, do you know where I am? He said, no, I don't know, but you could ask that guy. You know, it's like, oh, this is so bad.
But yeah, it's funny though, because it's, and I don't, you know, like Mont and I have done a lot of talking about bands that are that have generic lyrics and stuff like that. Winger never made the conversation, of course, but like when you talk about those and then you hear those things, but they're still like really listenable and engaging albums. They just have shitty lyrics.
Well, it's you know, it's I hate making fun of those guys, but they're all so great. I love that record. It's just that they didn't speak English. So, you know, their translator, you know, however that happened, however it got translated, just didn't work out as well. But I still sang along with Wait, Wait, Wait Till the Shit Hits the Fan. I mean, I was singing it to the top of my lung. You know?
Oh, it's so true. It's so true. I mean, I love a great lyric. I love great lyrics. I love storytellers. I mean, merely I'm attracted to storytellers in the lyrics and the music. But sometimes it's not about, sometimes it's about that groove. You know, really what it comes down to. If it's got that groove, you can forgive anything. I mean, hey, Kiss didn't have the greatest lyrics, but I love a lot of Kiss songs.
That's why I started. When I saw that in Madison Square Garden, you know, it was, Kiss Alive 2.
Yeah.
And I was, you know, 15, I guess, 14 or 15.
Wow.
And that's what made me.
You were there?
I was there, yeah.
And that's live album. That might be my favorite live album of all time. And
me too.
The fact that you're there, I mean, yeah, I mean, sure.
Yeah, I saw all those songs, and that was it. I was like, Ace Frehley, I'm going to be just like that guy. I'm going to be a rock star. And I knew it from then, and I was voted most likely to be a rock star in my high school yearbook. And I just knew it. There wasn't even a question in my mind. You know, I just, oh, my God, that's what I'm going to be. Because I had been on stage my whole life. I had, like, a stage mother. And I was like Oliver and Oliver and Pippin, you know, think about the sun, Pippin, you know, like on stage. My eyes are like, you know, horse's eyes.
That's hilarious.
But, you know,
that's
amazing
to be there.
Isn't that so important, though? Like that musical theater background, I think, is such a help towards, you know, music as a whole.
Towards performing, for sure. There's a lot of guys that get really nervous before they go out there, you know, and I'm a little nervous before the big shows, like the, you know, the 20,000s and up. Yeah, you get nervous before you go out there. But once you get out there and halfway into the first song and all your stuff is working and you can hear everybody, then you can have fun. But, you know, if you go out there and it sounds terrible and you can't hear the lead singer, and, you know, that's when you get a little worried. I went out one time on one of those big shows, and there was a what do you call the thing that people? Oh, a drone. There was a drone, and it came right down in front of my head, like ar, 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 ar. There it is, like in my face, like following me around, you know. And I guess the people that were working it were on the other side of the fence. Something like that will really jar you, you know.
People don't think about it, do they? They don't.
The great camera angle of
what it might do to the
of Reb Beach's nostrils. Yes.
It's pretty amazing. Is there a song that is your favorite to play on stage? I mean, I'm sure you get asked that question often, but it's just, is there a song that you're like, that's just the most fun song to play that I get to play?
Yeah, Still of the Night. When Steve Vai joined Whitesnake, they say that he came into rehearsal on the first day and said, when are we playing Still the Night? like, that's why I'm here. You know?
Yeah.
It really is just like the ultimate rock tune. It has everything. It's got the strings and the cool breakdown section and, you know, oh, baby! You know, like all that incredible stuff. And then I love playing Headed for Heartbreak with Winger.
Yeah. That's great. I got to say, my favorite Winger song is Down Incognito.
Yep.
That's such a cool song. I love it.
Yeah,
that's
for sure.
I just love it.
That's great to hear. I know that when that song came out, we thought we were going to just go huge. You know, like we've got the single, you know, it's undeniable. And radio was saying, this song is undeniable, but we have to deny it because it's Winger and Beavis and Butthead, you know, Yeah, we were on the bus, and someone brought that Beavis and Butthead cartoon on a VHS and said, you guys got to watch this. It's not good. And we were on tour, and we put it in and watched it and went, oh, my God. And then a week later, everyone stopped buying tickets to Winger shows. Wow. And we had to cancel the tour. That was just over because of that cartoon. Amazing. And because of Nirvana, you know.
Yeah. But yeah, it's true, though. I know that cartoon had a lot of, I suppose so. I mean, I actually remember there's a sequence. Not only did they have the, you know, the kid that wasn't cool had the Winger shirt on.
Yeah, the nerd.
But, but also, I mean, there was a part where they were making fun of one of the videos. And I remember they're making fun of it. And I'm just thinking to myself, man, it's not fair that any man is as handsome as Kip Winger. That's what I'm thinking to myself. It's just not fair for the rest of us. But he's like, I'm not even like, you know, I mean, the music is great. That's really what it comes down to.
Yeah. He was good looking. But, you know, I remember that first day writing with Kip. He was the bass player on some sessions that I did because he was the bass player for Bo Hill. And I was the guitar player for Bo Hill. And we didn't like each other at all. Like, I didn't like Kip and he didn't like me. And so Bo Hill said, listen, Reb, you can come up with guitar licks all day long. I hear you playing guitar and it freaks me out. You're like writing songs all day long and you don't even know it. And Kip Winger, you're an arranger, composer that studied, went to college for, you know, went to Juilliard to study composition. And you could take Reb stuff and you could write an entire album. And he's like, all right, I guess I'll do it. And I was like, all right, I guess I'll do it. And so we went into a room. And I played him the 17 riff, and he said, that's a chorus. Let's go to A. Turn on the drum machine. We wrote the verse. So we wrote 17 Madeleine and Time to Surrender the first day we wrote together. And I remember being on the PATH train back to Hoboken going, I have just met the most amazing human being on the planet, and I'm going to learn everything I can from this guy. And I followed him around like a little dog after that. Like you know that big dog and like Warner Brothers, you know.
Hey, Spike.
And he's like going down the street and like little dogs like, hey, Ralph, what are we doing today, Ralph? Totally me.
And Bo Hill is one of those producers. I mean, like, you know, I mean, he produced so many of the bands that we just love from that era. I mean, when you talk about like Warrant and all that stuff, I mean, his, you know, what does a producer like that bring to the mix?
All his mixes sound the same. They got this great sound on the radio. They got this compression on them that's just so lush and it really pops. And he's great with vocals. The guy makes any vocalist sound like, you know, killer. And I've watched him do it before. He makes you sing it 8 times. And then for each line that you sing, he rides the best performance of that one line. And does it throughout the entire song. And it's that kind of, you know, dedication and, you know, technical wizardry that makes his stuff so yummy to listen to, you know?
Yeah, it's so interesting because especially, and I think maybe I notice it more from having listened to, you know, so much of that music back in that day, but like there are producers back then that I could name where it's just like, oh, well that's like a Bob Rock production. That's Ron Nevison. Yeah. That's Bo Hill. These guys, they just have the sound.
Bo was a big Mutt Lange fan. And, you know, I think he definitely got some of his tricks from Mutt, you know, who was amazing. And, you know, Can't Get Enough, you know, that song Can't Get Enough by Winger.
Yep.
You know, the hey at the beginning of that. Well, we lifted that right off the Def Leppard record. You and me, babe. We just lifted it right off.
How did I miss that all those years? Well, I'm like, oh, I should have noticed that.
We sang over it so it wouldn't sound so blatant, you know. But when, you know, I talked to Joe Elliott, and now, you know, I talked to him once in a while because we've toured so much together and he's so nice. But he said, man, when you guys came up with that album and you had that song with the hey, and then the album cover was completely Hysteria. Like, you ripped the album cover from Hysteria. I'm like, yes, we did. Yes.
I never thought about that either.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, I
like mean, a I triangle.
Know the world.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's totally. You really. Yeah, I still love Winger. Don't worry.
Yeah, no, we're totally different than those guys.
Oh yeah, absolutely, absolutely. You know what? So you talk about you're like, okay, I'm going to learn all this from Kip Winger. What have you learned from David Coverdale?
I've learned to, you know, tone it back for David. You know, you go in to write with a legend like that, and he doesn't want to hear Carry On My Wayward Son. You know, he's not into like, he wants to hear something that I can play on acoustic, you know, three chords. That's what excites him. He's a hit songwriter. He's right into just writing basic stuff. And then it's up to me to add in the closest thing to Carry On My Wayward Son that I can get away with. You know, he's like, well, you do all the guitars, darling. You do the bells and whistles, but this is the meat and potatoes of the song here. And so he writes, sometimes he'll write something that to me just sounds like, you know, like a show tune. And then it's my job to sort of, and me and Joel to kind of rock it out. You know, the first day I came in, he had this. He said, all right, Rebel, here's my idea. If I can't have you, I don't know what I'm going to do. If I can't have you, I don't know what I'm going to do. And that was his first idea for the record. And and it was up to us, me and Joel, to kind of rock that out. And he knew that too. He wanted that. He knew that wasn't how it was going to sound. But, you know, at first I was like, wow, I don't really like this idea. And I didn't tell David that. But then I couldn't get the freaking idea out of my head. You know, it's like, Jesus, David. He writes these things that are just so hooky that you can't get out of your head. They're undeniable. And that's the beauty of David, is that he's a great, great songwriter. And you just have to kind of rock up the stuff that he does, because he's not a technical guitar player, but he can play those chords, and he writes it on this little acoustic guitar that sounds like crap. But that's his writing thing, and he picks it up all the time. You know, I lived with David for a year, and he'll be walking by, you know, like, and he'll just like stop and sit down and start, you know, playing anything, you know, just in any chord. And it'll be like, yeah, it's hooking. You can't deny that stuff, you know.
And it's a skill, right? I mean, you know, that, like, being able to write songs like that is a definite skill, because we've talked to so many musicians, and there's some who truly struggle with being able to write songs as a whole. And then there's some that you know, it just, like you say, like you say about you writing riffs, where it just kind of pours out, you know. So it's the creative process is really interesting in that regard.
Yeah, it's completely different from Kip Winger, who wants Carry On My Wayward Son. He wants, you know, the most progressive thing that I can come up with. You know, the weirder the better with Kip, because he just doesn't want it to be what everyone else does. And if I came into him with, you know, a 1-6-4-5, which is Every Breath You Take and I Will Always Love You, and, you know, every pop song, there's like a million pop songs with that chord progression, he'd laugh me out of the room. But David would say, I love, that's wonderful. What is that? Let's do that again. You know what I mean?
So then how does that differ from, you know, you working with Fiona in the early days?
I didn't write anything with Fiona. I never wrote anything with Fiona. Fiona was how I got my start in the business. What happened was, I was playing a top 40 band in Fort Lauderdale. And I hated playing Jump on the keyboards every night, even though I had so much fun, you know, playing in Fort Lauderdale and all around the South Florida area. It was amazing. And I was gorgeous and didn't know it. And it was just like heaven. But then, you know, I wanted to make it. I was hungry. I wasn't going anywhere in this top 40 band. So I moved to New York City and moved in with a guy I knew who lived there. And I got a job as a singing waiter in the Bowery, which was right across from CBGB. So there was music there every night. And hung around at the music stores, which were all on one street, 48th Street, had all the music stores. And I talked to other musicians, heard about an audition for Fiona on Atlantic, and it was out in Long Island. So I took the train out to Long Island, which took forever, and got there. And in the room, there was like 10 guys, and they were all wearing spandex with like giant hair. And, you know, just the total 80s thing. And I was wearing exactly what I'm wearing right now, which was just jeans, a T-shirt, and a hoodie. And I walked into the audition. They said, if you can play guitar, you have the gig, because these guys all look like idiots. And I was like, okay. You know, we were all wearing the same thing. I was like, yeah, we're probably supposed to be in the band together. So, yeah, so I went to do the session. It took me a couple weeks to do the whole album. They had had seven guitar players before me, including Rick Derringer, do the album. You know, it was a huge budget record. And Bo wasn't happy with the guitar players. And he loved me because I played whatever he said. I had never seen a Marshall amp before. I'd never played through one. Thank God Kane Roberts from Alice Cooper was in the next studio and showed me how to make a Marshall sound good. On that thing. And so at the end of it, Bo Hill said, so Rev, I don't want to insult you, but how does $500 sound for the entire record? And I was like, $500? All right. I was so excited to get five. I'd never seen $500. So, you know, then Bo told a bunch of other producers that there's this kid who's easy to work with, who plays great, and he'll do your whole album for $500. And so I started getting work right away. And then, of course, I joined the union and all that. But I did Chaka Khan and Howard Jones and, you know, Kenny Loggins and Roger Daltrey, and you just did all the Atlantic sessions because of Eddie Van Halen, believe it or not, because Eddie did the solo on Michael Jackson's thing. And then all of the giant pop artists wanted a flashy guitar solo on their album. And I didn't think about that until right now. Isn't that something?
That's amazing. That's crazy. It's so true. I mean, and it was so visible. Like, that's the thing, right? When you think about that solo, like, it's ubiquitous when I think about Michael Jackson, and I think a lot of people, you know, it's just like you think about this amazing guitar solo.
Yeah, because there had never been anything like that before in a pop song, really. Like you know, there's solos in pop songs, but not like that solo.
Yeah.
It had tapping, and it was just real, like... It was kind of lazy and drunk, but it had all the vibe, just drippingly cool. So unique that every Chaka Khan wanted it, you know, everyone wanted it. So that was how I was in the right place at the right time, you know, and because of him, I got those gigs. I got those sessions.
It seems like we should ask you for any other thoughts or memories of Eddie Van Halen, just because, I mean, I think we're all just shocked by that. You know, that loss. I mean, there's no worse. I'm
so shocked by it. And, you know, I don't know that Winger would have even been around if it wasn't for Van Halen. I know that I wouldn't have been on the cover of magazines if I didn't tap, because that's what made me a shredder. Mm-hmm. I don't play fast really otherwise. So so I owe everything to that guy, to Eddie. And I met him a few times. One time I met him and he said, I think I know you. He said, if you're the guy I think you are, then you're really good. And I was like, wow, I hope I'm the guy that he thinks I am.
I'm sure you were. I'm sure you were.
It's great. That's
great story. We should get back to the album.
Yeah, right? Actually.
We got to wind it up pretty soon.
Yeah, that's what I was about to say to you is, we should get back to the album, give you the chance to, you know, to plug it and tell everybody where they can find your stuff. And, you know, I mean, it's just a blast talking to you. Best interview ever, Brett?
It's right up there. Honestly, Reb, I mean, I know we could easily talk to you again, because we've got a lifetime of experiences to talk to you about.
That'd be great. I'm here if you need me. Talk anytime. Love talking with you guys.
All right. Well, for sure. I mean, then we should absolutely book something again.
Yeah. The new Winger album should be in May.
Awesome. That would be fantastic. Okay. All right. Book it in. New Winger album. Red Beach for 4 hours. And but right. Please tell everybody where to keep up with you. Tell everybody, you know, best place to find the album. Any news, anything about that. And thanks very much for your time. Ahead of time here. This has been an absolute pleasure.
Oh, thank you so much. Yeah, for me too. And you know, it's just I'm giving lessons, and I think it's officialredbeach@gmail.com. I'm doing a master class on November 7th with the Rock Camp people, and you can just Google master class Red Beach. And then, you know, I have the new Winger stuff is coming out, but my album is coming out on November 7th, and you can pre-order it if you just kind of, you know, Google Red Beach, A View from the Inside. I think it's only like $12 if you pre-order it, which is pretty cheap. And I think that you'll like it, especially guitar players, I think, will like it. It's definitely the most I've ever played on a record. It's all just kind of my soloing, but it's nice music, and it's not all just bang your head stuff. It's very listenable and very inside. If a jazz player heard my album, he'd say, well, that's not a jazz player.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
That's, yeah. You know, it's kind of, it's, but it's very likable. It's very melodic. And Steve Morse gave me a great compliment and said that the thing that really stands out about my playing is my phrasing, which is kind of, the phrasing is like, you know when to play fast and when to play slow, and you don't play the typical rhythms in your soloing, you know, the typical notes that anyone else would go to. So that was a great compliment, and I hope that I hope I get good reviews on it, and it's going to be something, because not a lot of people release an instrumental record, and it was kind of hard to get a record deal because typically they don't sell. So I'm hoping that this one, you know, sells.
it honestly should. I mean, it's a fantastic album, and I do urge everybody to go out and listen to it. If you like the guitar, then I think you'll love this album, because I love it and I love the guitar.
Thanks, Brett.
But yeah, so Reb, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Yes.
And we look forward to talking to you again. And now I feel like going and picking up my guitar. So
all right, do it. Great.
Yeah, if you could teach Brett how to play well, then you are a great teacher.
Oh, I've got lots of tricks. I have lots of cheats that'll work. You know, just like don't play, don't pick every note. Just do lots of hammer-ons and tapping, and you can get through it. Make it sound like you're good.
Nice. Awesome.
And thank you so much.
Thanks, Reb. All the best.
Good.
All right.
Good talk, guys.
Thanks.
Take care. Bye.